today is very special for us because, as you know, the Commission, in terms of its current mandate, has been mandated to look into the human rights situation, but also to collect and preserve evidence for the purposes of establishing criminal accountability and really to make the work of the hybrid court and the other transitional justice mechanisms a lot easier by being able to hand over the evidence collected to them. And so in that context, the manner in which the Commission has gone about its work has been quite different because it's focused on not only documenting the violations, but really looking at this question of criminal responsibility and, of course, what we call linkage evidence. The Commission, of course, had to prioritize its work because while the mandate was given to the Commission in March last year, the Secretariat only began its work in Juba in August of last year. And what that meant, of course, was that it would not be able to look at everything. And so when it looked at the chronology of the kind of incidents that had taken place, it chose to focus on five emblematic cases which involve the Western Barguzal, Central and Eastern Equatoria, and, of course, the Upper Nile State. And it looked at cases primarily where the incidents had taken place between 2016 and 2017. The other criteria that it used was it didn't really want to focus on stuff that other bodies had done already, you know, either UNMISS or even the government or OSHR directly. And so it was very careful on how it selected these cases. I think at the outset, the one thing that I do want to say is that it was absolutely extraordinary the way in which victims and witnesses came forward and were willing to share their experiences with the Commission. What it did say to us is that it's really possible to collect the evidence and to ensure that, in fact, it is preserved. So from that perspective, I'd like to salute the courage of the survivors, those in South Sudan, and of course in the refugee camps, because there's an enormous resilience that people demonstrate, even as they are suffering displacement, the fact that many of them are refugees and, you know, outside of the country, and of course have been the subject of so many horrible violations.
Madam, when did you start the investigation and what did you specifically look at during your own investigation?
You know, the team were on the ground, I think, by the end of August. And by October, they began to fan across the country, with some of them also visiting neighboring countries so that they could interview people. As I said, we chose really to focus on the conflicts that had taken place during the 2016-2017 period, looking really at what we called emblematic cases. We also focused on what we called thematic issues. So in particular, we looked at the way in which the conflict affected women and girls. We looked at the impact of the conflict on children. And of course, because the mandate mentioned this question of conflict-related sexual violence, we also focused on that aspect as well. Now, of course, in the context of our work, we picked up an extraordinary number of violations that involved really targeted killings, abductions, rape, sexual violence, the destruction of villages, pillaging, and looting, many of which I think would constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. What was particularly shocking for us was the large number of people who were now out of the country and the fact that 60% of them are actually children. I mean, that's a staggering amount of children. And, you know, in terms of the figures, 75,000 children have been separated from their parents, with more than 2,300 having been killed in the war. And I think what the other fact, which is really quite heartbreaking, is the fact that 25% of the conflict-related sexual violence cases involve children. You know, it really, I think, begs the question of what is going to happen to young people in the decade to come, because if you look at their prospects for education, this is almost completely destroyed. And at the end of the day, many of them, the only life they know is one living in a very militarized society. And that's not healthy when one thinks about peace options going forward.
Some people who might be listening to you in South Sudan today will be asking a lot of questions. One thing is releasing this report, and they will be thinking of, did you manage to identify the perpetrators, and what happens to the perpetrators? Because they said justice delayed is justice denied.
I think you're asking extremely important questions, because the commission, of course, in the context of its work, identified more than 40 individuals who may, in its opinion, bear responsibility for these human rights violations, and of course, ultimately, in some contexts, would constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. Now, what the commission is going to do is, it's not going to publish the names in its report. In fact, it has compiled a confidential dossier, and it will hand that dossier over to the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And what the commission is doing is, it has protocols which the High Commissioner's office will use to assess on how it should hand those confidential dossiers over. Now, that then, you know, this question of accountability comes into play. We were very pleased last year when finally, I think, the cabinet in South Sudan approved the draft statute and, of course, the memorandum of agreement. But, of course, it needs the signature of either the president or the foreign minister or an official designated by the president to sign off so that, in fact, the African Union can move to establish that court. We ask in our recommendations that, in fact, the African Union, with the support of the UN and, of course, the government of South Sudan, establish the hybrid court as soon as possible. We also point to the fact that there really is an important need to begin the work around the Commission on Truth, Healing and Reconciliation. And given the kind of violations that South Sudanese victims have suffered, really important to begin a process which will lead to the establishment of the Compensation and Reparations Authority. In our view, the transitional justice agenda that is set out in Chapter 5 of the agreement is a very important program for sustainable peace building for South Sudan.